I'm Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing a wide range of research projects in which our academics are currently involved. I would like to welcome Dr. Helen Gregg, Head of Communication Therapy at the University's Institute of Healthcare. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Gregg. You're going to speak to us about the European Clinical Specialization Course on Fluency Disorders. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of a background to how the course came to be.
Thank you for inviting me. This course came about during a staff meeting of the European Network of Speech-Language Pathology. We have 17 different departments, teaching establishments actually, across Europe, and we meet up every year. We run a summer school and an intensive program funded by Erasmus program, and we have been lucky enough that it has been funded for a number of years. Actually, this is the 14th year, which is quite a unique situation. And during the staff meeting, we obviously are always trying to plan how we can, as a network, develop and establish better links and primarily better standards, academic standards, within our programs. So one of the ideas was to write a proposal for harmonization of specific modules related to the speech-language therapy course, which in Europe could be a bachelor's or even a master's degree, depending on the teaching establishment. In our case, it is BSc honors in communication therapy. We actually submitted a number of proposals for different projects, but today we're going to concentrate on the fluency project. 8 partners from 5 different countries agreed to write the proposal, and we have actually Lesius from Hoge School from Antwerp, who accepted after being nominated to be the coordinator. We submitted the proposal, and fortunately it was approved for funding by the European Commission under the Erasmus program again.
Why did you opt for doing a project, creating a project that actually creates a course as such? Because you could have got together to do some other kind of activity, some other kind of project. What was so interesting about the idea of actually creating this course?
Okay, actually this project has 2 different components. One idea was, one of the main objectives is actually to harmonize the already existing modules in fluency disorders in the undergraduate program. Now, as I said, the undergraduate could be a bachelor's or a master's, depending on the university. The other objective was actually to create a module for the already qualified speech-language pathologist, what we call a specialization course. It doesn't lead you to become a specialist in that area, but it could be one component of, that's what we're hoping to do, actually, a master's program. We chose fluency because it is basically a very contentious issue, and there are different schools of thought. Obviously, you get academics who may be more focused on one theory, one model rather than another, and it's very important that we give our students and also our practitioners an overall view of the different schools of thought. So we decided that we were putting it together, and so far it has been very successful.
So this is going across sort of cultural barriers. The reasons for the various schools of thought would be because different research has been done in different countries. What would be the reason why there isn't already a sort of homogeneous approach to certain aspects of your work.
Yes, I mean, in case of fluency and fluency disorders, what traditionally we call stammering or stuttering, as people would know, there is no cure as such. However, there are different ways of helping individuals with such a problem, and you can tackle it from the psychological point of view, from the actual speech symptoms point of view, fluency shaping, and so basically there are different models, different, and yes, some culture aspects come in it as well, but it's mainly the way research has developed. So, you know, if in a particular university they've concentrated on the psychocognitive aspect, then they're bound to probably give it more priority in that institution. But it's very, very important that we give our students what is available locally. And then as clinicians, they may decide that they would opt for one school of thought in terms of intervention. But nowadays, rather than reflecting on the clinician, it reflects on the client. One client will do very well with one model, depending on his personality and other issues. And another, you may opt to choose another model of intervention with another individual who may have, similar symptoms. But
one thing that I've noticed over the years, these last few years, several times I've had press conferences, to announce that some funding has been given to preparing a course. And I always find that the journalists are always a bit sort of dumbfounded by the idea that they haven't been brought there to talk about a course that's actually already functioning, or the launch of a particular, this is actually just the initial stages. And sometimes it can take years to be able to actually create a course. What actually goes into it, the creation of the course? So, I mean, you sit round a table discussing it, you put forward suggestions. How does one actually go about creating a course?
As people may know, creating a course is not easy. It's not just having a piece of paper and a pen and you write it down. And especially if it is something like this, where different European partners are involved, who may have different policies within their teaching establishments and different objectives. So it's not easy. And in fact, the funding you get from whichever source, I'm talking about Europe at the moment because this is a European funded project, is very often is to help you with the kickoff. And then you're expected to generate some money or, use your own resources to keep it going. And in fact, this is exactly what we're doing. The money was given to actually plan. There was justification for this because, especially with the expansion of European states, basically we realized that in speech pathology, there are different levels of education and of training of these professionals. And it was very, very important, especially with the mobility and, people wanting to work in different countries, that you establish standards and harmonization, obviously, that would reflect in the harmonization of training programs and education programs. So, yes, it involves a lot of work. And in fact, before we actually wrote the proposal, there was obviously there were a number of meetings. I mentioned the staff meeting was actually one of those. And then, what happens very often, we invite each other to have these short meetings of steering committees and write the proposal. Actually, in the funding, you are also allowed to have a number of meetings about the project. I mean, this is crucial. And then, obviously, basically, you move on from there. We have been doing this for the past 2 years. Basically, discussed the harmonization, agreed upon them eventually of the undergraduate program, and planned and are now implementing the specialization course. It started, the first course started last year, and we have 24 students from 7 different countries.
Where is it taking place, actually?
Yes, that was another issue on how to actually go about it. And we decided, because these are going to be students at the end of the day. I mean, the specialization course is for clinicians, for practitioners who are already qualified people. But obviously, you have to consider that when you self-fund, or if you have some funding, it will not cover very often all that is involved. So we decided that we would choose places where the low-cost airlines actually, and it worked.
It's so a very practical way of doing it.
Because we thought we wouldn't attract students otherwise. We had already two intensive weeks, one in Belgium and one in Ireland at Trinity College. And the course actually involves also a practical session, which you would do in your own host country. So the partner institutions had to agree that they would offer the clinical supervision, and there are also a number of assignments that they do, and so far it's been working very well, in fact. But yes, a lot of planning and a lot of meetings.
Before continuing, I'd just like to remind listeners that this is Research Matters, and I'm Patricia Camilleri, and I'm talking to Dr. Helen Gregg, Head of Communication Therapy at the University's Institute of Healthcare. Yes, perhaps Dr. Gregg, you could talk a little bit about what they actually do in the course when they come and they have these intensive moments in wherever. What do they actually physically do? I mean, what do they study?
It's actually a very intensive course, as you can imagine. 1 week where there are lecturers from the different partner institutions, and they're all specialists in that particular area. In our case, we delegated this to Dr. Joe Adjous, who is a member of the academic staff of our division, and his area of speciality is actually fluency and fluency disorders. So they give lectures, they give seminars, they give workshops, theoretical units, as well as workshops for techniques, you know, enhancing techniques, and seminars, research-based seminars. And then they go back in the meantime, until the next intensive program, they go back to their host institution, and they are actually supervised for their clinical placements, even though they're clinicians, because they are geared for the becoming eventually specialists in this area. But this course doesn't lead you to become a specialist. It's part of it.
Mm. And clearly there are many languages involved in this adventure. So how does the linguistic side of it impact on the course?
Yes, and of course the students would have different proficiency, you know, and competence in the language use, which is of course English. We decided it would be English, but it is one of the selection criteria. Obviously, the student has to be proficient. It still varies. There's a lot of diversity, but it's very, very important, because all lectures will be delivered in English. Now, the clinical supervision may not, for obvious reasons. I mean, if you have clients who are speaking Flemish, then the clinical supervisor would probably be very fluent in that particular language, and so will the student. So, you know, clinical supervision, and it is actually carried out in the host institution, would be carried out in a different language. But whatever is reported in writing, assignments and whatever, it still has to be English.
And in fact, one of the aims of the course, I think, is to stimulate the students to look beyond their borders, clearly to gain from the experience of other countries, I would imagine.
Yes, and that has been a very fruitful exercise, in fact. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you do not only exposure of all the different aspects and the models of fluency and fluency disorders, but yes, obviously techniques and intervention programs would reflect on cultural issues and whatever, and students are exposed to all this, and it's very, very fruitful and very interesting, and students actually mix as well. So and these are clinicians who are mixing from different cultures, different with using different languages, even with regards to the profession. You know, in one country it may be very well developed, and this is relatively a young profession, and very well respected and autonomous, whereas in another country it may still be somewhat being established.
Mm. So seeing other people actually working at a certain level in the country, I suppose, must be a help to those who perhaps haven't quite reached that that level, and sort of push them to promote the work that they're doing in their own country.
Yes, yes. In fact, we have had a couple of candidates where it was slightly difficult for them to receive clinical placements within their specific country for reasons which you could think about. And that was another issue. Where do we send these students for placements? But it has been resolved as well. And students actually gain a lot of experience from that, because then they can take back what they've learned, even what they've observed, and they could obviously enhance the development of that specific profession or specialization within their country if it is still in its infancy or, you know, not.
Sure, they can gain the confidence, yep, watching other, yeah, people having already reached that level. Here in Malta, you were saying that this is a young discipline, mm-hmm, really, mm-hmm, communication therapy. I know you've been working now for quite a few years in the area. You're secretary of the worldwide association, mm-hmm, of mm-hmm, communication therapists. How do you see the development here in Malta? Do you think it's sort of moving in the right direction?
Yes, I'm very pleased to say that we're very much respected as a training establishment. In fact, the problem is that we're flooded with requests for Erasmus students, especially the Northern European countries, because they have a master's program which is equivalent to our BSc honors. So they want to send students to us, and very often we have to be selective. But the main issue, I think, we're becoming very well established. We're not still in our infancy. I think it's teenage years now. But I think the impact which we made was mainly when we really started thinking about research, started running our own research projects, and being awarded projects. I mean, we are also a coordinator of a national project, and it has been funded by the European Union. And I think, you know, that, as you very well know, is very competitive. And as a university, we have high standards, not only of education, but even research-wise. I think that actually gained a lot of respect. And in fact, we have other modules which we are planning, and we have actually been awarded funding for specifically one other module as well in motor speech disorders, but we are submitting other proposals. And very often the partners want us. I mean, they approach us, that they want us as partners. And that is very good news, I think. And it's very encouraging. Awesome. Especially because we're a very small division, even within our university. I mean, we are a small university. But we are gaining high reputation, even amongst the very good and reputed academic institutions across Europe, such as Trinity College and Catholic University of Louvain. I mean, they just send students, which is very, you know, very interesting. And they invite us now as lecturers as well, and they invite us to work with them on research projects, which is obviously
that's
very
really
encouraging.
Good to hear.
Very encouraging.
Seen you working sort of over the years, and it's nice to see that there are some fruits at this stage. The issues in communication therapy, do they cross borders? The issues are similar in all countries, or are there pockets of certain issues in some areas and certain issues in others?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, definitely they are across, cross-linguistic, cross-cultural. But then, yes, there are cultural issues. For example, even the idea of hearing impairment. I mean, there are some cultures where they consider it as not as an impairment. So they wouldn't want their children to be provided with amplification, with hearing hearing aids and with, and even, for example, in some northern African countries, there are a lot of genetic causes of hearing impairment within families. They run within families and they're at high risk very often because they have dominant genes. You know, they have a 50-50 chance and they still would go ahead because they do not cause. So these are issues. So it's very, very important that you have to respect those cultural issues. You can't just go as a speech language therapist and say, you know, I'm recommending that your child receives, you know, this very advanced technology because they wouldn't, you know, consider it. So you have to respect that. But yes, across the board, and even the incidence and epidemiological studies are indicating that prevalence and incidence are very similar across cultures. In fact, one other study that we have, which is funded by the EU project, is part of it is actually running an epidemiological study on communication disorders in Maltese children.
And we would just ask you, apart from this, you know, what other things? I know that you're working on other things, not just on the UCSF.
Yes, actually, yes, one other main project is MR equal E project. I've been working on it for 4 years. We did a lot of work, and we ran an epidemiological study,
which is basically, exactly
we wanted to know how many, it was pediatric, so mainly children, how many children in Malta and Gozo have a communication problem that merits attention by a speech-language pathologist. So far, we are actually still analyzing the data, but preliminary data is indicating that we've got very similar rates to other developed countries. You know, we came out with very interesting data regarding bilingualism, for example, because, you know, as everyone knows, this is a cultural issue in Malta. And there was the perception that if you expose a child to bilingualism, it may actually delay his language acquisition and it may be detrimental. And we're just publishing one article by in a very reputed journal, the International Journal of Bilingualism, where we have, these are the preliminary data indicating that actually by 3.5 the bilingual children, such as those in Malta, not only catch up but they do better in terms of development than the monolingual children. So, and we were, because this is the these are the claims that have been put forward recently, but they wanted data, they wanted clinical data, and they were very pleased to receive such information.
Yes, this was just the right place to try.
Exactly, because we're a captive population, and I've been involved by a number of institutions to actually disseminate this information, because this completely changes the approach of parents, and now even children who are having difficulties are not actually being forced to stick to one language, or the parents are being forced to expose them to one language, because it doesn't seem to be detrimental at all, and they will be able to cope, but they need to be guided on how to do it. So, you know, a lot of parents have a lot of guilt feelings, you know, if the child is delayed in developing his speech and language, should I then stick to one language? Perhaps this is confusing him. And in actual fact, research data is indicating that, you know, they just need to stick to the home language, whatever that may be. It could be, you know, one, two, or a mixture of both. You know, we used to be quite obsessed, even as speech language pathologists, but really, it doesn't seem to be.
You don't mind code switching?
Code switching has become a psycholinguistic, actually, issue. It seems to reflect competence of the child, actually. Whereas in the past, we used to think, oh my goodness, he's, you know, he's very incompetent. He's not proficient in any of the languages. Whereas it is reflecting psycholinguistic competence of that child. Managing.
And adults, because I code switch the whole time.
Yes, you don't need to worry.
I'd be glad if it was.
Yes, it's quite a relief. It's quite a relief. Apparently, the brain is must be, you know, working very hard to be able to cope with two languages, and eventually children sort it out, but initially they may struggle a bit, you know. I had recently a child in the clinic who told me what is a hearing impaired child, profoundly hearing impaired child, who's doing very well in two spoken languages, a five-year-old girl, and who has been implanted actually, and she told me what is chair in English. You know, she knew there were two terms, at least in Malta, but she wasn't quite sure which one was the English one and which one was the Maltese one, which is very encouraging, actually, you know, so...
You're talking about dissemination. You said you're going to be printing this article, publishing this article in Journal of High Quality Journal. What about dissemination of that kind of information to people on the ground rather than just to academics who are going to appreciate your research but are not going to be perhaps personally affected by it? Whereas, you know, when you're dealing with people, you have to sort of tell them about it. Otherwise, the perception is going to remain always the same.
Yeah, that's quite true. In fact, it's part of the project that you have to disseminate the results. And we've run seminars to clinicians and also the Association of Speech Language Pathologists. I think we really need to work harder with regards to awareness, public awareness about all this. I mean, the university is also helping us, you know, definitely. But it's very, very important that, as you said, we do not keep the results in ourselves. We need to disseminate and exploit, actually. And at the end of the day, you know, because it may require a change of mentality, a change of intervention, and sometimes reassurance as well. So, yes, indeed.
Old habits, as the proverb says, die hard. So to actually overcome perceptions of things with some sort of new ideas, which are based on research data, etc., not just ideas you come up with out of the top of your head. I think it's important that somehow it doesn't happen once, that the information is given on various levels, from a radio like this, and perhaps something in the press, so that the new information is passed on in different ways.
Definitely.
So, you know, drop, and eventually
something.
The message will get through.
Yeah, definitely. And same thing with fluency and fluency disorders. You know, fluency disorders, there has been quite a negative attitude towards stammering. Oh, there's no cure. I can't do anything about it. There's so much that people can do. And especially in speech-language pathology, we're talking about prevention and early intervention and the prognosis, that is, future, especially in children who have communication disorders. It's so positive. It's so much better if they are picked up early, irrespective of what communication difficulties they may have. And we actually now, there's enough research and findings indicating that we could actually prevent some specific communication disorders if we manage to pick up any factors, any criteria that are related. So, you know, perhaps I could take the opportunity here and say that if there is anyone who thinks that anyone else may have some communication difficulty, particularly children, they really need to refer very early as possible. You know, wait till he goes to school. Now, we can actually predict now that a child could have even literacy difficulties at 2 years of age, because there are specific characteristics and tests that we could administer to indicate, and then obviously guide the parents, help the child, you know, etc. So,
well, that was very, very interesting, Dr. Greg. Thank you so much for coming on the program to talk to us about how communication therapy is moving in Malta. Thank you very much.
If you would like further details about the University of Malta's research projects or any other information, please access our website at www.um.edu.mt. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.